General Song.
Not coming back to the UK. Instead, we would return to our civvy billets in Dihan. This we did, and there we received some supplies, ammunition and uniforms, but eventually it was decided to send us back to the islands in the Skeld Estuary, in fact, to Hoos. Spell Goose, G-O-E-S, Hoos. On South Beaverland. And there we would, again, they put us with the civilians who were pleased to have us living with them, as the Germans still occupied the other islands north of Walcheren and South Beaverland, mainly Skellendiveland, over Flackey, and North Beaverland. These islands were still occupied by German forces, and so the civilians were very pleased to have us be living with them. Unfortunately, the billet that they put me in with one of my sergeants, the gentleman of the billet, who will be known as Hype, Hugh Britt, we know him as Hype, had previously been in the Dutch Territorial Army and was called back into service. So this meant that his wife would be alone with two Royal Marines. We were both, I was 21, Wilf Worsley, Sergeant Wilf Worsley, my companion, was a fella about 25. Lay, our landlady, was a young lady of 28, roughly, and this didn't seem quite right. And I told Lay that we wouldn't be allowed to stay as we were. We'd have to find somewhere else more suitable. But Lay saw Colonel Moulton, appealed with him to let us stay. And Colonel Moulton, his remarks, well, if I can't trust two senior NCOs, who can I trust? He saw me and told me that you're being left there on your best behaviour. Please act like gentlemen and stay with her. She'll be much happier with somebody there. So this we did. And this was all right. But then during the time that we were there, we did lots of operations on the other islands. We used to go on patrols and land and stay overnight, listening, finding out what sort of troops were there, if possible, bring back a prisoner. And this we were doing. And on one of these occasions, we went, and Wilf Worsley, my fellow boarder, stepped on a shoe mine and he lost his leg. So obviously he had to come back to UK. And again I said to Lay, I can't see him allowing me to stay on my own. It just doesn't seem ethical. But again she saw Colonel Moulton and he said, I can trust him, he'll stay with you. And this I did. As long as we were there, I stayed with her. And Hype has been here with his niece to see me. We've seen him on a few occasions since the end of the war, but now both of them are dead. But we did build up a strong friendship. We're still in touch with the niece. We have lots of contact with her. Eventually we moved from Hoos, and the end of the war was now fastly approaching. Everyone could see that the war was nearly at end. And we finally moved onto the River Maas. And this, as I recall, was our last real active port of call. I do recall that on VE night, we were actually stationed in a monastery, I suppose you call it, but there weren't nuns in there, there were monks, somewhere where the monks were living. B Troop, my troop, was stationed in there. I now had a new troop commander, Captain Johnny Square, the gentleman who was a lieutenant, had the unfortunate job of clearing dead on D-Day. He'd now been promoted to captain and had taken over B Troop, his first troop command. We spent a few days there, as I recall. I can't be specific on the time we spent there. Eventually, we were told we were moving into Germany to Minden. Minden had been taken over by the naval authorities as their headquarters, and we had the job of a very unfortunate job of moving people out of their homes to find billets for various troops. But this we did, and cordoning off certain areas, And this we did. And we had, Minden was a very pleasant town to be in. They'd suffered no war damage at all. Had a beautiful river Weser running through it where we could have swims. And we were told we couldn't fraternise, of course. There was no fraternisation at that time. And then I think my last operation, we moved from Munden, and I'm coming to the end of my story virtually now. We moved to from Minden up into the mountains to a little village called Harth. And there we lived with like gamekeepers, whatever you call them. And we spent a few days trying to augment the meat supply for the German people. We were shooting deer in the mountains with these professional deer hunters, whatever they are, we call them. But they were very pleasant people, although they were Germans, and we were living amongst them for a few weeks, I suppose. And then eventually we came back to the UK, and unfortunately the end of 48 Royal Marine Commando. And it had been a very, very hectic 2 years or so.
Did that operation hunting the deer have a special name?
Yes, Operation Butcher. I should have mentioned that. Operation Butcher, it was called. And that was our plan. I think it was the first time I ever ate, and the only time, I think, I've ever ate venison. They were quite prone to make it a venison sandwich.
Were they easy to destroy?
What, the deer? Well, the majority of us were not very good. Our snipers had a field day. They enjoyed it. But it was not an enjoyable process just killing deers like that. It's not like killing a cow or something like that. I don't know why it should be that such, but it isn't. But it wasn't very enjoyable. The people were very hospitable to us. There I had a pleasant journey. I've never done it since. I had a ride on a footplate of an engine, a very big German train engine. We were told we'd gone to the next village called Ringelstein. We were having a drink with the locals, and some of our members were billeted in that area. We wanted a train back. Oh, yes, there'll be a train. And the train came, but there was no trucks, no carriages, nothing. There was just a train, so we had to stand on the footplate. And the German trains are very big things. It was a very pleasant journey.
Did you obey the non-fraternisation order in Germany?
Yes, we did. Well, with regards to female fraternisation, but I can't say we did with the males. As I say, we lived with them, we mixed with them when we were up in the mountains at Harth. Not so much with the people of Minden, but they were a bit, what shall I say, they were not friendly to us in the majority of cases. The one case, a doctor who was a cripple, we'd moved him out of his comfortable home, and his daughter came to see me a few days after we'd moved him out and asked, could she have the wheelchair out of the cellar? I was under orders not to do such things, but I did give way to her. I did give her the chair for her father. I thought it was only you meant to do it. We were told we mustn't let them have anything out of home. We were to clear them out, and that was it. And it was not very enjoyable. I mean, they were ordinary civilians. They didn't love us. I suppose they felt envy towards us. But it was fortunate in as much as Minden had not really felt the war. Not that we could visibly see. There was no signs of bombing or anything. So whether that helped, but they were not exactly friendly. There it was. But she asked me, could she have the wheelchair for her father? And I did give way and let her have it out there. That's it. But that I can say now, it's all gone by the board. They can't hit me for it now.
How do you feel now about having served with the Royal
Navy? I thoroughly enjoyed it. I was a fool to come out, I feel. Colonel Malton told me in as many words. I was 23 when I eventually left the Corps. And he said, you're a fool, but at this time, we were married. My wife was expecting our first child. She didn't fancy the service life. She's regretted them many times since, so as I have. I think I could have made a better life for myself. I'd have stayed in the Corps. I really enjoyed it, and I've got every respect for them, apart from the recent issue when they put a program on the television a month or so ago, and I was disgusted to see the way they operated. I've told the aide-de-camp to the general in as many words. He's had lots of letters, and his reply is in the Globe and Noddle, which I've received this morning. And a lot of us are disgusted with the language. In my day as a senior NCO in the Royal Marines, to use bad language to other ranks was abusive. And it was just as abusive as physical abuse. And this program, I don't know if you saw it on television, it's been about a month ago on, I don't know what channel it was on there, to tell you the truth. But anyway, the language is so abusive that we feel very strongly about it. We've all written or sent messages to the Commandant General Royal Marines expressing our disgust. There are numerous letters in the Globe and Noddle today. There's a letter of apology from him. I belong to the Wolverhampton branch of the Royal Marine Association. We've sent a letter of condemnation of the way they treat the recruits, the disgusting way they treat them. So I am a bit perturbed, but I'm still full of admiration for the Corps of Royal Marines. As far as I'm concerned, they're the finest force in the world.
Can I just go back to D-Day?
I forgot to mention all of my preamble. I didn't mention the reason for me being sent back recruiting. On July the 13th, 1944, there was a special investiture of commando troops and airborne troops, all of whom had had an immediate award for D-Day. And Montgomery held this investiture in a sort of a shell hole or a quarry behind the lines. And he gathered us round after we'd all received our particular awards, and he sat us on the dunes and he said, "You get round me, sit round me, and we'll have a photo taken, and you will all receive a signed copy of that."
So this was the award of your military medal?
Military medal, yes. Unfortunately, the investiture was arranged shortly after the war, or late in, well, still in the forces. We were supposed to go to an investiture at Buckingham Palace. I sent the name of my wife, another relative, but then it was called off. King George VI was too ill. It was supposed to be a special combined services, airborne and commando forces. But it didn't take place, unfortunately, and I received it with a letter from King George VI on the phone. That's my phone. George VI had to cancel it due to his ill health. So consequently, I received my medal through the post with a letter from King George VI apologising.
Could I just go back to D-Day?
Yes.
If I can just take you through it again, just so I get it clear. You were in B troop.
Yes.
And you were talking about the demolition troop.
Yes, I was a demolition section in B troop. Number two section of every troop was designated as a demolition troop. We were trained to such. Each troop, A, B, X, Y, and Z, all five fighting troops, the number two section of each troop was designated for demolition purposes.
So that was your allotted task for D-Day?
That particular task, apart from leading the section wherever they had to go and doing whatever we had to do in the street fighting and all this, whatever came up.
Can you just take me through what the crossing was like again and the
horrendous
problems you had?
Horrendous. It's obvious that the craft were unsuitable for the job. They were too light in the rough seas that we encountered on 6th of June. The ramps were not steady enough for quick access from the craft, and quick access is desirable. And I'd say, along these lines, we were very pleased when they gave us the Buffaloes to land in. At least we were going to have a dry landing. You see, with an assault craft, which is a flat-bottom boat, you go directly onto the beach, and the ramp comes down flat, and you run over it. But with these things, they can't get directly on the beach. They hope that they get close enough as the ramp will get to the beach, but with the way the tide was and the underwater obstacles, this was impossible. So we were all left high and dry. X and Y troops and B troop were farther out at sea, and we saw quite a few of members of that troop trying to swim ashore, go down. Y troop didn't get in at all, apart from their commander, Major de Stackpoole. He swam ashore and was wounded. One or two did get ashore. He was one as did, Major de Stackpoole. But his troop, basically, didn't come ashore at all on D-Day. They were taken back to the UK. They were picked up by another craft who refused to bring them in. They asked him to bring them in, apparently, but he refused and took them back to the UK. And they didn't join up with us for a few days. So we'd lost, that troop was lost complete to the operation. X troop were well out in the water and lost a lot, drowned, in addition to the people that were lost on the shore. As I say, it was estimated that there were 223 of us of the 500 that had left the UK the night before. Colonel Moulton, I'll say General because he eventually did become General Moulton, Colonel Moulton had 223, that's his estimate, when we got ashore, to do the job that 500 were supposed to do.
And you describe the problems disembarking. Mm-hmm. If you can just go over that again, please.
Well, I say the problem were that the machine gun post was operating from the left-hand side as we landed, and we were completely open to it, apart from the smoke screen that Colonel Moulton had put down with our small 3-inch mortars, which it was all right up to a point. It absolutely assured the beach, but you'd got to get to the beach, and this was wide open to the machine gun fire. And the ramps were in the swell, which was very heavy. The seamen on board had jumped into the water to try and hold them steady for us to come down. Another thing that happened to me, I lay on the deck and my pistol of my Tommy gun got caught in the ropes of these ramps were pulled out on ropes, and it whipped my pistol grip off, smashed it. I only had a little stalk to hold, but we managed until I could get a replacement.
And it was Canadian troops?
Canadian troops of the North Shore Regiment and the Ford Galley Horse. And at our interview, briefing interview, the commander of the Canadian force, that particular force, his very words were, come high water or hell, or hell or high water, we'll get you ashore. They did get us ashore, but not completely unscathed, unfortunately. But they lost a lot of men. And there's a monument there at Santa Ban where we landed, in the form of two books, about as high as a door, and all our dead are on the one page, and the civilians that were killed, and the Canadians who lost far more than us, the two pages are taken up with their dead that were actually killed at Santa Ban where we landed. And then there are various monuments and streets at Langroon named after our participants. I say Captain Perry Street, there's a 48 Commando Street, there's a Greenberry Street, there's a General Moulton Street, and there's all these streets, isn't there? And they think a lot of us. We're held in very great respect, as we are on Walcheren.
And then once you disembarked, you then went straight up the beach?
Oh, yes. Well, we didn't. We went to the far side of the beach, onto a small embankment, and Colonel Moulton then sort of got us together and gave us instructions where to go, and where we should have assembled with the complete unit, just behind the beach on the road that ran parallel with it. But it was a bit disorganised, to say the least. And say it wasn't a very nice operation. Walcheren worked much better because we were more experienced. This was, as a unit, was our first experience D-Day. And I know Colonel Moulton's words, we finished our training on that day, the day we landed, at a very heavy cost. No doubt about it.
And then you had the meeting with Moulton.
Yes. Oh, I saw Moulton at various times throughout the day. He was with us virtually all the time, wounded though he was. Both his hands were wounded. There was lots of our officers who were wounded in as much as they'd got hand movements and they'd got their slings just for, but they stayed with the troops. Lots of them did. But in point of fact, I think every Every troop commander was either killed or wounded, and most of the subalterns. Our officers took a hell of a pasting. I say, in B Troop's respect, two of the three officers were killed on D-Day.
And then we come on to the business of the attack on the strong points.
Yes, yep.
And the attempt to put charges against the wall.
Yes, yep.
Can you just take me through that again, please?
Well, I say, we made the charge up with the most of the material that we could gather. We'd lost a lot as we disembarked, but it was very ineffective. It was a dead loss, and we were exposed in taking this down to the wall. My section and I were exposed to fire from the strong point, and then immediately we got under the protection of the wall, which we were trying to destroy. We then came under this hand grenades coming over the wall to us, and I say we had to be recalled, we had to come back, and then we received instructions that the order had been given to maintain, hold what you've got, and prepare for the counterattack that was expected from the Panzer Division, which was heading our way. But it did materialise, I say. And then the next morning, on June the 7th, we had the two centre tanks, again manned by Royal Marines. They came down and broke through, and we entered the strong point, took the prisoners. And virtually after that, it was a matter of clearing up snipers in the area. One thing I omitted to tell, while we were policing Langroon and Santaban, there was reports that there was a sniper in the church spire, and I was given the task of taking my section to fetch him out there. So we went into the church, and we went up this twisting staircase, and I was trying to bend my Tommy gun. I was leading my section up there, but there was no one up there, fortunately. We went to the top and cleared it. The same church now, there's a stained glass window there with a certain writing there to 48 Royal Marine Commando.
When you took German prisoners, for example, in that strong point,
yes.
What kind of mood were they in? Or condition?
They were in terrible condition. They were a mixed breed. They were some old, some young. They were mixed. Apparently, they were not the elite of the German army, I wouldn't have thought. Once we got in close order, they easily gathered themselves up, once we got inside the strong point. They were very nondescript, really. I can see them lining up there. In fact, I think I got reprimanded a bit. One was a bit slow in putting his arms up, and I think I gave him a jab in the tummy on his stomach, and Colonel Moulton didn't like it. So no need for that, Sergeant. But that's...
What condition were you in by the end of the Normandy campaign?
Not bad. A few minor wounds I'd got. I'd say I'd got this shrapnel in me, which remained with me for years. I'd inquired when we came out the forces of the MO, what do I do? Do I apply for a pension? No. His remarks to me were, you'll be able to buy penicillin over the counter at the pharmacist very cheaply. This was his attitude, fair enough. So I didn't. I was wounded again at Walcheren with a mortar shot, but nothing that ever kept me out of the line. I could both times I was wounded, slightly wounded, they could be treated on the spot. But it's down in my records that I was wounded.
When you went back to civilian life, was it easy to readjust?
No. I found it very difficult. As I say, secretly, I wanted to stay in the Corps. I felt that I could have done a good job there. I could have made a good life for myself. Obviously, I wouldn't have held the rank that I held then. I'd have had to have gone down certain way. They've got a system whereby you get a temporary rank, an acting temporary rank, and then a permanent rank. But I didn't find it easy.
What exactly was the problem about readjusting to civilian life?
I don't really know, but I was not happy with the jobs that I could get with my qualifications, because I'd got no real qualifications. I think secretly I thought that I would have become a professional footballer. That was my strong point. And I did sign eventually for my local team here in Walsall, a league team, but I never made much headway with them. I perhaps wasn't as good as I thought I was. But the reason they let me go, or they didn't send for me, was the fact that I'd got to get a job. It was the first winter after the war, when we had a very, very bad winter, 1947. A very serious winter, and all the building industry was off. Football was off for weeks on end. And a fellow member of 48 Commando, named Lishman, was playing for our local team. And all the building industry, they closed the industry down, and we had to report every day to the local council, and we were given picks and shovels to clear the bakes, the frost-hard snow off the roads. And I was doing this one day, and the footballers was going past where I was working, and Dougie Lishman, he was a dispatch rider with headquarters troop, he saw me, and I'd played with him in the Royal Marines, played football with him. And he says, "What are you doing?" And I says, "We're doing this. The jobs of the building industry is closed down completely. Well, this is what we've got to do. And if we don't do this, we get no money. We've got to." He said, "Why don't you come up to the football club with me?" He said, "I'll introduce you to Harry Hibbs," who was then manager of Walsall, the old England goalkeeper. Harry Hibbs was years ago, before your time, when I was a youth. And so he did, and they signed me on. But at that time, all football was cancelled. He said, "What are you doing?" I told him, and Harry says, "Well, I'll clear it with the Labour Exchange. You can come up here 2 days a week training." And I used to go up on the Tuesday and do a bit of training, and I'd pick the teams for the following Saturday, put them on the notice board, and I would be picked in the reserve team because I hadn't made the mark, you see. And we'd go up on the Thursday, and there'd be a notice across the board, all matches cancelled. And this went on for, 10 or 12 weeks. There was no football played in this country for a long time in 47. And I thought, I've got to start work. I've got a wife and a child to think about. So I went and started a job. And in those days, in the building industry, you used to work Saturday mornings, normal time. And I had a card come that particular week that I'd got to be at the football ground early on the Saturday morning to travel down to somewhere down the West Country to play for the reserves. Cheltenham, I think it was. Cheltenham. That's right, Cheltenham. I've got to go to Cheltenham, which entailed me being at the ground before midday. And I've got to be at work till midday. And so I didn't go. And he decided he didn't want me no more at the football club if I couldn't turn up when selected. So I threw my chance in, and I had to content myself with semi-professional football.